We're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Will Weber is on the board. Will Erskine booking the guests. In the newsroom, Dino Weeks and Dave Woodard. Today, NASA's rocket to the moon was scrapped after a gas leak. That never stops my dad from launching a show.
Hey!
Here's Scott Thompson!
Always time for a fart joke, right?
Good afternoon. It is 900 CHML. I'm Scott Thompson. Will Weber on the board. Dad and Dave in the newsroom. Jump into the fun. Love to hear from you. Send us a note, Scott Thompson at 900CHML.com. I just realized that there's like 2 days left in the month. 2 days left in August, and then we're into September. Like, where the heck? All of a sudden, I'm sounding like an old guy, like my parents. Where did that go? What happened there? By Wednesday, we're on to a new month, and or after that, and then the long weekend, Labor Day, and kids are back to school. There you go. Done with that. Thank you very much. Summer of 2022. Please come back. It wasn't long enough. Oh man. That being said, onward and upward, join and enjoy the last week of summer of 2022, unofficially, of course. All right. Beauty day out there. Nice day. It's hot, real hot and windy sort of. So you get that kind of feeling that anything can happen. So just be aware, we could get some severe thunderstorms, and such. So anyway, just keep your eyes peeled for that sort of stuff, because it is in the sort of situation where we could be quite prone to some wild weather a little later on in the afternoon. All right, jam-packed show coming up, lots to talk about. As Kurt mentioned, the NASA rocket didn't make it up. We're going to talk about that coming up a little later on. Passport delays continue. Unfortunately, in things around the airport slowly getting better, but not really. And then, of course, the big news over the weekend, verbal attack on Chrystia Freeland, the Deputy Premier of Canada. And, you know, I mean, anytime you see this, it shouldn't happen. End of story. I understand people are frustrated. I understand people are angry. But it can't get to this point, because this just stops good people from entering politics, and we don't want it to get to that extent. That being said, we're going to talk about this in depth over the course of the afternoon, and we're going to ask if the Prime Minister and other leaders have any role in this, escalation, in this frustration, in this polarization we have seen. Because in my lifetime on the planet, the current Prime Minister is the most divisive Prime Minister we have had, certainly that I can remember, and very much compare that divisiveness as to what was going on during the Donald Trump days, just on the opposite ends of the political spectrum. And as soon as it goes too far to one direction, then obviously the extremists come out on the other side and try to pull it back. And at the end of the day, we have minorities on the extreme dictating policy for those of us that just want to go to work every day and raise a family and put a roof over our kids' house, or a roof over our kids' heads, rather. So anyway, I'm going to play you a clip, and this, it's edited and such, but this will give you an idea of what Chrystia Freeland went through in Alberta. And, you know, oddly enough, No, I'll talk about this later. No, I'll bring it up now. Oddly enough, I remember Chrystia Freeland being smug to our friends in the South because she did not travel with a security detail. And she said, we don't need it up here. And, you know, it's Canada. And at the end of the day, whether it's extreme or not, no matter how polite it is still divisive. Here's a sample of what happened.
Chrystia.
Yes.
The f*** are you doing in Alberta? You traitors! Get the out of this province!
You don't belong here.
You're a traitor! You
Yeah, go ahead and hide.
All right, guys, you got a traitor in the elevator. Don't touch me. Go.
We are
Do not
leaving.
Touch me.
We are leaving.
Do you love her? Do you love Chrystia Freeland?
No. Get.
I will not. Don't tell me to get. I'll walk out my own power, okay? So back off.
It's just
back off. I know this gentleman here.
I
fuck shouldn't even be allowed in Alberta. She's destroying this country. Your kids are gonna have no future. Okay? I hope you get it. Somebody's gotta get it. Because we're the only ones fighting for this country right now. And it sure as hell isn't her.
All right, that's the encounter Chrystia Freeland, Deputy Prime Minister, had in Alberta with an Albertan obviously not pleased with her. Here's what the Prime Minister had to say about the comments.
As leaders, we need to call this out and take a united stance against it, because no matter who you are, who you love, the color of your skin, how you pray, where you're from, your gender, you deserve respect and you deserve to live in peace without fear of threats or violence.
We also, as well as calling it out exactly like the Prime Minister said, we have to ask what causes this and what we ourselves are doing to inflame these sorts of extremes. Here's what Pierre Poilievre, I would guess front runner for the Conservative Party, had to say.
Well, it's absolutely unacceptable, and I can relate, of course, because I've been the subject of so much online harassment and abuse. My wife has received so much horrific material directly to her social media account that we've had to hire a private security firm to protect our family against all of that abuse. So unfortunately, this is all too common and all too long-standing. We have to put an end to it and demand that everybody treat other Canadians with respect when we debate political ideas.
All right, there you have it, Pierre Poilievre on the harassment that Chrystia Freeland has experienced. This comes from divisive leaders on both sides of the political spectrum. This comes from divisive leaders. Divisive leaders who create and play on the extremes for political gain, and then you wonder why you have a divisive electorate. It starts at the top, and it's great to call it out. It's great to call it for what it is, and that's accurate. But you also have to ask what's causing it and what you are doing to divide or polarize people who don't agree with the same things you do. I think that's a question all politicians should be asking themselves as well. So Niagara Falls, obviously we know just in the news last week because the GO Train stuff, now wants to become Canada's Music City. I thought Hamilton was supposed to do that. Anyway, I'm not going to argue about it. And it kind of makes sense when you think of Vegas and all that other sort of stuff. And they're exploring an option of putting out a proposal for some sort of Music City strategy. To talk more about all of this, the Mayor of Niagara Falls, Jim Diodati, and he's with us now. Jim, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing well, Scott, and thanks for having me.
So what makes a music city? How do you become one? Is there a badge? Is there a diploma? Is there an official certification? How do you get this, Jim?
Well, there's a secret handshake and a tattoo, but we'll talk about that after when we're off air. But so we put in a request originally to the province to become a music city, and there's a little bit of a process. And what we're trying to do, we're trying to explore how we can use our current assets. So, I mean, we've got a lot of hotel rooms and how we can utilize them to increase visitation and extend the stay. And we thought music would be a natural way to do that. Everyone loves music. Everyone loves Niagara Falls. If we bring the two together in Niagara Falls, how can we expand tourism?
Obviously, we're seeing Falls View do something like this. They've done it in the past. What is your plan? What are you looking for? More club action, more halls, medium-sized halls, bigger events, stages? What sort of plan?
So all of the above. So we're looking at doing it organically. So all the small clubs and including the big stages. I mean, we've got a lot of stages in this town, and we figured if we could have events going on at all the locations, it would just be an excuse to come to Niagara Falls. If you like music, pick a stage, pick the kind of music you like, pick the venue that you like, and you know that it's kind of like when you go to Las Vegas, you never have to ask, hey, what's going on this weekend? There's always something going on fun. And Niagara Falls, we want to do it the same way, but with music. So you'll know whatever kind, as long as you like music, you're going to find a place that suits you, that you'll have a good time, and you'll take away some great memories.
Obviously, this has to, you have to get investment involved and players involved. How do you get business involved in this? How do you get them interested?
Well, that's why right now we're doing the request for proposals, and we're doing a study right now to find out exactly how you do that. And that's a great question that you asked, Scott. So we're trying to find out exactly how we do that, how we start from the grassroots and then work our way up. And we also want to enhance local artists and encourage local artists. When I say local, I don't mean just here in Niagara Falls, but I mean Southern Ontario and in Canada, and how we give them a presence and give them a stage. Because every big artist performing on a major stage started at an event kind of like this. And we knew that this is going to be a popular place. We know we've already got the infrastructure. We know we can handle big numbers. We have a place for them to stay and for a place for them to eat. Now we're going to give them stages all around town where they can perform. And we're hoping we're going to develop some great talent and show people a good time in Niagara Falls.
Obviously, because in many cases, Niagara Falls is a destination location, this seems like a perfect fit. Why hasn't this been done before? I mean, I guess it has in some ways, and they've tried through the casinos and such, but this just seems to be a natural fit.
Well, we did something similar, but it was just at the tail end of COVID. And I think it could have been done a lot better. Just there were still some restrictions and concerns and a little bit of confusion around rules. So and we did a little taste of it, and boy, was it successful. We even did a late New Year's Eve show a couple months after New Year's with Blue Rodeo and a number of other performers. And we could feel that people love the music scene. You know, for 30 years, we've been doing the big Canadian New Year's Eve show in Niagara Falls. And I like to say we offer a buffet of fun and excitement here in Niagara Falls. So there's meat for the carnivores, vegetables for the vegetarians, and everything in between. And we want this to be one more of the buffet offerings here in Niagara Falls and turn it into a whole meal on its own.
Obviously, Niagara Falls and any city associated with a heavy hospitality industry suffers during a global pandemic. Is this just part of a plan to reignite this sort of thing post-COVID-19? Because again, there's, as you mentioned, there seems to be that pent-up demand. People want to get out.
You know, it is. And at the same time, you know, it's funny. Every time things go sideways, there's an opportunity to pick something up and learn something new. And sometimes, as they say, necessity is the mother of invention. And we went through a tough time, so we had to reinvent ourselves in a lot of ways. And we came up with a lot of creative ideas, and this was one of them. And sometimes we just take for granted that we're going to have big crowds because that water going over the rock. And we know we're going to get 20 million visits every year, no matter what. Well, we're trying to find a way to get a little more juice out of that orange, give it a little extra squeeze. And we think this is going to be one of the opportunities with music. Who doesn't like music and eating and drinking and the whole entertainment scene? It all ties together. So that's why we felt that we did so well with this little thing that we did at the end of COVID. We thought, what if we did it on a grand scale, marketed the beans out of it, and really opened the city up and had this major music event? And that's what we're going to do. And hopefully it's going to grow legs and it's going to end up becoming a major draw for us.
That's a valid point too, Jim, because again, because you've got that natural attraction there, you're going to get people anyway. And, you know, why not take it to the next level? Why not see how far you can go? I can't let you go without asking you, the premier down there talking about 7-day GO Transit. What does that do for Niagara Falls?
Well, you know, it's great. And I mean, just before COVID, our numbers were great. We're beating all the projections that Metrolinx put out for us. And it's only a matter of time that they're going to add a bunch more times. And it's just great because it means you can live here in Niagara and you can work anywhere along the Greater Golden Horseshoe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the big challenge is always the highway, and it's either going to be congestion or construction. And you never know when you get on that highway, but there's no traffic jams on the train tracks. Mm-hmm. And it's much more predictable and their on-time number is fantastic. So we're grateful that the province is expanding the GO train right to Niagara Falls. And I know yesterday, you know, a bunch of us went to the Blue Jay game, and we count on that GO train to go a lot of places. And the more we can invest in public transit, it'll take the pressure off the highways, better for the environment, and definitely gives people an opportunity to live where they can afford to live and go grab the good jobs out of town.
Jim Deodati with us, Mayor of Niagara Falls, talking about their strategy to become Canada's music city and also talking about 7-day GO Transit from Toronto to Niagara Falls. Jim, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
Thanks, Scott. You too.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
We always would like to bring in Paul Delaney from York University, retired professor of astronomy, to talk about anything that's space related or what have you. And of course, we have talked at length in regard to the next stages of space exploration, which is Mars and again, reconcentrating on the moon as a stage through to Mars and such. And almost took a step towards that direction again today, but safety always being paramount, it was scrubbed at the last minute, the launch. To talk more about all of this, Paul Delaney, York University, Emeritus Professor of Astronomy, and with us now. Paul, thank you for your time. I hope you're well.
I am indeed, Scott. Always nice to chat.
So it must be a real nail biter if you're a scientist and you're sitting at a master control somewhere and you're counting down from wherever, and all of a sudden you get into the last few seconds and there's a red flag. What happened here?
It is a nail-biting experience. I guess this one was a little easier to take because the countdown held at T-minus 40 when we were all informed that there was an issue with what they called an engine chill down or a bleed. And what that basically means is that the four big engines at the bottom of the big orange external fuel tank of the Space Launch System, those four engines were being fed a small amount of cryogenic fuel, liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen. That's at about minus 180 degrees Celsius. So before you start throwing literally hundreds of gallons, hundreds of liters per second into those engines, you cool them down so that the thermal shock is less on them. Well, the problem this morning is that three of those four engines chilled down as expected. The fourth did not. And basically, NASA tried troubleshooting it, but they ran out of time. And rather than not understand what the issue was, they scrubbed the mission today. They're examining the data. They may come back and launch on Friday. They may come back and launch on Monday, or they may push it to the end of September, depending upon what they find out.
Okay, I know I'm going to oversimplify this a lot, Paul, but I'm guessing you can't check these things until this process has started. My question is, why don't you check this stuff before you start counting down?
Well, the short answer is you can't.
Yeah.
But, think of it this way. The rocket is sitting on the launch pad and it's empty. It's like your car. It has no fuel in it. How do you test the fuel pump if there's no fuel in it, right? So yeah. Same sort of idea here. You have to have the liquid fuel almost to flight pressure, almost as fully fueled as you can get, and then you begin to bleed this cryogenics into the engines. So until you're at that stage, which is deep into the count, you just can't test it.
Right. So the process has to start before you can get to the stage and find out whether you can move forward or not. How significant is an issue like this? How much of a delay is this?
Good question. Listening to NASA, I don't read into it that they are overly concerned. That is to say, it's not an engine issue. They really do believe it's an issue associated with feeding the engines enough of the cryogenic fuel to get to the temperature profile they want. These engines are actually very well understood. They are literally former shuttle engines. So we know what these engines are supposed to look like and how they will perform. Very, very reliable. But of course, they're being put at the base of a much bigger fuel tank, and they're being asked to deliver a lot more continuous thrust than they were with the space shuttle. So the piping, if you will, the plumbing that leads to them has been redesigned. And while they have done testing, testing of that system and got satisfactory results, it's now literally at the point where, you know, we want to see the whole performance with all of the fuel and so on and so forth being delivered to these engines. And that is where we think the issue lies. The plumbing might not just be big enough. There might not be enough capacity for the bleed lines to chill the engines. So the solution could be a little bit as simple as, well, we'll just bleed a little longer than we were planning to do. If they have to go back and replumb it, so to speak, with a bigger fuel line, well, that's a much bigger issue. We don't know is the short answer, but I'm caring to bet that they will find the right balance of time and fuel to get into those engines to get to the temperature profiles before Friday.
This was an unmanned rocket. Obviously, we have to remember this is in the test phase. Delays are part of the process.
Oh, absolutely. This rocket has never flown before. The best analogy I can give you is go all the way back to November of 1967. That was the first time we flew the Saturn V for the first time, completely uncrewed. We know that 2.5 years later, or 2 years later, Armstrong and Aldrin were walking on the surface of the moon. But in 1967, the Saturn V had never flown. So we're in exactly the same analogous situation here. Artemis has never flown, and it's a much more complex vehicle than the Saturn V was. It's comparable in height, and its performance is meant to be basically the same, if not better, than the Saturn V. So this is a big deal, and NASA, of course, has got all of their lunar exploration and potentially flights to Mars based upon the Artemis architecture. They will not fly unless they are very confident that the system is as spec requires.
So once it gets off the ground, what is this flight all about? What's its objective?
The objective is quite simple. Make sure it all works. So we're going from launch to Earth orbit to translunar injection to lunar orbit to bringing the Orion capsule back at quite phenomenal speeds, about 40,000 kilometers an hour, splash down in, I think it's the Pacific Ocean that we're coming down in. On board, there are literally human mannequins that have got thousands of radiation sensors and accelerometers. The aim of the Artemis 1 mission is to make sure everything works and that it is safe for people to fly 2 years from now.
And why are we going back to the moon again in 60 seconds, Paul?
Should never have left. The moon the moon is the jumping off point. If we can live and sustain ourselves on the moon, if we can turn this into basically a science oasis, if we can turn it into an industrial complex, who knows what lunar exploration benefits are going to result here on Earth. It's analogous to going into space for almost the first time, and look how society now depends on low Earth orbit. So we're going back to stay, and you know, the cliche, for the benefit of all humankind.
Next time, after this time, this rocket flies, will it have a crew?
It will, and there will be a Canadian on board. Put your money down on which of our four Canadian astronauts will be on board. But yes, Artemis 2, 2 years from now, will be the same flight plan, more or less, as Artemis 1, but with people on board. First time back to the lunar orbit since 1972.
Exciting time to be an astronaut. Paul Delaney with his Emeritus Professor of Astronomy, York University. Paul, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Take care.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
Good news. Anytime governments are giving cities money, it's usually good news for the city. You'll never really see them. Well, let's not even go there. But the federal government investing $3.6 million in six infrastructure projects in Hamilton, including the redevelopment of Beasley Park. And rather than list it all for you here, I'll bring in people who know way more about it than I do. Ryan McHugh, who's a manager of tourism and events for the city of Hamilton, plus Meredith Leonard, a senior curator, learning and interpretation, city of Hamilton, and Cynthia Graham, manager, landscape architectural services, city of Hamilton. To all three of you, welcome so much. Thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Welcome, Scott. Thank you so much for having us. This is Ryan McHugh, manager at tourism events.
Let's start with you then, Ryan, because obviously there's cash coming, so it gets spread around through various departments and such. What does this mean for tourism and events for the city?
Absolutely. And as you said, you know, anytime money from any level of government is making its way to Hamilton, that's a positive news story. And the $3.6 million that were invested in Hamilton, as you mentioned, are across six projects, and they're so wide-reaching, I had to bring a little backup with me today to talk about all of the investments. As it relates to tourism, so the federal government had invested just south of $500,000 in the renovation of our visitor center. So that is located on the ground floor of Lister Block. Mm-hmm. So with this money, we're going to be able to do a complete rehabilitation of our visitor center. We're going to completely upgrade all of the technology, and we're seeing more and more as visitors come to town, they're getting their information from our website. That's tourismhamilton.com. So this will allow a complete upgrade of technology, which will help us, you know, better refer businesses to, visitors to restaurants, business districts, and shops. As well, we're incorporating some museum space as well, where we're going to tell various Hamilton stories that will incorporate Indigenous, BIPOC, and other voices. And it really is a neutral downtown space, which will really allow us to work with the community and create an own destination in its own right. So that's, Scott, a little bit just of the visitor center piece, but I don't want to monopolize your time because there's quite a few other projects there if you wouldn't want my colleagues to speak to those.
Let's bring in Meredith Leonard, Senior Curator, Learning and Interpretation for the city. What does it mean for your department, Meredith?
I represent Hamilton Civic Museums, and we're so excited for this infusion of funding. One of the projects that's going to allow us to move forward is the Hamilton Children's Museum, which is an incredibly, incredibly popular site in Hamilton. In fact, we haven't been able to meet the demand, so we're really looking forward to expanding our site, increasing access and inclusivity in this totally barrier-free space. It's also going to incorporate indoor and outdoor spaces for learning, for connecting, for gathering, and just bringing the community together. Our second project is St. Mark's Church, which is going to be a really exciting civic space as a host for cultural programming, community gathering, and it's going to provide a really important green space for the Duran neighborhood. And we're just really excited to rehabilitate and repurpose this heritage building to add a really vibrant part to the community.
How do you explain the Children's Museum and its success? And it just keeps on going. It's amazing.
It is. I think everyone has such wonderful memories of the Children's Museum. It's a wonderful place for play and for learning and for people to connect with each other and with their own families. And I think that's a really powerful experience. And this money is going to help us provide that experience for many more Hamiltonians and visitors to the city.
And Cynthia Graham, Manager Landscape Architectural Services, what does it mean for your department?
Yeah, thanks for having us on to talk about these exciting projects. So what it will mean for us is the ability to move forward on these two important parts of ongoing work that we have at Victoria Park and at Beasley Park. We've been working on both of those parks for many years, trying to update aging infrastructure and respond to needs of the community. For Victoria Park, we'll be able to construct a brand new spray pad and a new sun shelter, improve the accessibility and walkways through the park. And for Beasley Park, we'll be able to turn Kelly Street into an amazing new pedestrian space and improve some accessibility and pathways throughout the rest of the park.
Here's a question to anyone that wants to answer it. Obviously, we're just coming out of this global pandemic or wherever we are in it and such. How has that changed the way you do things and the way you look at projects moving forward?
So one, if maybe I can start quickly. From a tourism perspective, clearly the tourism industry was one of the hardest hit by the pandemic. So during the COVID restrictions and shutdowns, we relied more and more on digital content. And, you know, that's something that as we, you know, come out of the restricted environment, we're going to accelerate even further. So that is, you know, say a lasting effect, but that allows us to get more current information to visitors quickly and, you know, around the clock 24/7. So from a tourism perspective, that's what I'd like to share with your listeners.
All right, Ryan McHugh with us, Manager of Tourism and Events for the City, Meredith Leonard, Senior Curator, Learning and Interpretation, and Cynthia Graham, Manager, Landscape Architectural Services, all for the City of Hamilton, splitting up some government money to spend on our great city moving forward and all working hard to make sure that we get the biggest bang for our buck. Ryan, Meredith, and Cynthia, thanks so much for the time. Be well. Good luck with all this.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Bye.
Lots to talk to Elliot Tepper about, Emeritus Professor of Political Science, Carleton University. Russia preparing to begin military drills with China. Also, obviously, the energy crisis and what it means moving forward. And tourism. Should Russian tourism be allowed in Europe? Should officials be going back and forth? Elliot Tepper with us now. Elliot, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Oh, thank you, Scott. Same to you.
What about the tourist situation? We know that a lot of Russians go to Europe throughout the summer, part of the tourist season and such. Is that all still in full swing, or is there been blowback from that?
Well, there's already been some cutback from the Baltic states in particular prior to this. But the announcement by Estonia that they really want the EU as a whole to just stop all tourists, that would be a major step up. I don't think Hungary would go along. But the key thing here is that the purpose of that is not to punish the Russian tourists. It's to have them wake up, as the leader of Estonia said. They have to wake up and realize what this unprovoked aggression against Ukraine has done.
Do you think we're going to see that? I mean, and what will Russian citizens do, the average citizenry who just wants to take a vacation somewhere and all of a sudden can't go? How will that?
They were going, a number of them, to Crimea, which, of course, is Russian-occupied Ukrainian beaches, among other things. And the recent explosions in Crimea may have put a crimp in that. And, of course, there's always Turkey. The fact that Russia is being treated as a pariah will be treated at home by Mr. Putin. It's just further evidence as to why Russia has to be returned as a great power to the world. He'll try to turn this to his advantage. But it's really the slow motion impact of all the various sanctions, including this one, which will be affecting people who can travel and want to travel. But it's the slow moving nature of the impact. How long will it take for the Russian economy and for the Russian society to actually feel the effect of all the blowback, primarily the sanctions, compared to our own ability to hold out against the rising price of oil at the pump and gas at the pump? And what about Europe? How long can they hold out against the cutting off of gas supplies? And can they find enough gas supplies elsewhere or energy supplies elsewhere to backfill prior to the coming of winter? So it's that kind of a race going on now between basically who can suffer the most, the quickest, or the longest.
Are we learning anything from what Europe, specifically Germany, is going through in regard to the weaponization of energy? A lot of people predicted this way back when. We remember when Germany, like cutting edge R&D for renewables, now shutting down nuclear and depending on... Yeah. On Russia, how did they get here? I mean, you know, it seems as if this played right into Putin's hands.
Yes, the answer to your question is Germany learned its lesson, or have there been changes? I think one of the big takeaways from the invasion so far is that Mr. Putin is the father of a new Europe. Germany was gambling much earlier, and with some justification that complex interdependence, as us political scientists like to call it, would bring post-Soviet Russia into Europe. It would so entangle Russia into Europe that obviously they would no longer be aggressive or hostile. That has been proven to be a bad bet, and now everyone's scrambling. But the enlargement of NATO, the transformation virtually overnight of the decision of Europe to at least try to get off these energy supplies, to get out from under, This is a major accomplishment by Mr. Putin so far. And now, going back to where you opened up, Russian tourists can't travel, they can't go to Eurovision, et cetera, et cetera. So Mr. Putin is the father of a new Europe. The joining of Sweden and Finland into NATO, which seems imminent now, really is a huge transformation of the security environment for Mr. Putin. So he has gambled that... he can win. Europe gambled that they could tame Russia or engage Russia. Russia was what, you know, there was talk, Scott, of Russia joining NATO back in those days. But those days are over.
It sort of sounds like, you know, you say tame Russia, it's like taming China. Everybody thought the same thing with Hong Kong.
Yes. China's an interesting case here. You opened up by commenting that there's these joint military drills. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to be said about those. One of them is the sheer scale of it. If China and Russia, remember they met on February 14th, you and I talked about it, I think, at the time prior, just as the Olympics were about to end, and Mr. Putin actually traveled, unusually enough, he traveled out of Russia, he traveled to China, and they signed a long declaration saying that from now on, well, two things, a lot of things, but one is they're both opposed to color revolutions, these uprisings that are people's power that can chase dictators from office. They don't like that. But they also said they were going to have a strategic partnership without boundaries, without limits. There were going to be no forbidden areas of cooperation. And then after that, the invasion went ahead into Ukraine. These joint military exercises are notable for their scale. I'm just quoting from that newspaper article that you're drawing on, more than 50,000 troops from a number of countries, 5,000 weapon units, 140 aircraft, 60 warships. This is a very large scale drill, and it also involves China and Russia working together, but also India is there, along with a number of other countries, an interesting collection of countries, actually. So Russia is saying, basically, okay, you thought you could close us off. You think you can isolate us, this visa, no tourism and so forth. We are showing you that we have a way to be out from under those sanctions. We will operate. We will continue to be a world power that everybody has to pay attention to. And that's in part what these drills are all about.
Elliot Tepper, Emeritus Professor, Political Science, Carleton University, Changing World Order. Elliot, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Oh, you're very welcome, Scott, and same to you.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
Earlier on in the show, we were talking about Chrystia Freeland, Deputy Prime Minister out in Alberta, getting harassed by obviously an angry Albertan out that. There has been an increase in hate and harassment targeting not only politicians, but also journalists, particularly women. To talk more about all of this, Jeffrey Dvorkin with a senior fellow Massey College, former director of journalism at the University of Toronto Scarborough and author of Trusting the News in a Digital Age. Jeffrey's with us now. Jeff, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
I'm well, thank you. I hope you are as well.
So far, so good. I mean, I think we've talked about this before, Jeff. Why are we seeing this? Why is this happening? It seems we've forgotten how to agree to disagree. And I'm going to throw another one at you. How much of this has to do with the political climate? It's the leadership we have.
Well, all of the above and some of the below, Scott. I think I've been thinking about this since you called to ask me to think about these things. And one of the things that occurred to me is that we are seeing traditionally male areas of endeavor, politics and journalism, now being taken and run by more and more women. And at a time when there's a lot of economic insecurity out there, COVID, a shaky economy, a transition from industrial to service models. Folks in Hamilton understand this better than anybody else. It got me thinking about, and this may be a bit of a leap, so help me in this. after World War II, when all the men came back from service overseas, and their jobs in the factories and the shipyards and in the farms had been run by women. And when the men came back at the end of the war, they basically had all the women fired. Go back to raising families, go back to being homemakers. We're going to take our old jobs back. And slowly through the 50s and 60s, there rose a sense of what we now see in retrospect as the growth of the feminist movement. I think what we're seeing now is the next iteration of that feminist and diverse movement that has been pushed forward partly by the times, partly by the economy, certainly by the digital culture, where people, mostly all men, of course, or mostly men anyway, are saying, we're not going to take it anymore, and we're angry as hell, et cetera, et cetera. And so you have this rise of a kind of an anti-female vibe out there in the culture. And politicians are saying, you know, you can't do this. You have to be more inclusive. We have to be more diverse. And the people who are feeling that their traditional roles have been usurped. And I think that's part of what we're seeing now. That's my theory.
That's fascinating, Jeff, because I'm sitting here thinking that, like, wow, I didn't realize this was a gender issue. And I understand, you know, it's a bit of a stretch for you, and I see where you're coming from. However, it seems that aggression, that frustration, it's on both sides, whether it's male or female. It's not like it's just angry white men here. You know, it seems that the population is just disenfranchised. So, sorry, go ahead.
No, please, please. I was going to say, I think you're right. And I think what we're seeing is certainly in media terms, we're seeing a kind of a generational gap. Lisa LaFlamme happened to fall on one side of that gap by virtue of the alleged allegation that we need younger, more diverse audiences. The issue of her graying hair is really a pretext. I think this is more about how is the digital divide going to work in favor of all segments in the society? And this is the real challenge, is that on the one hand, we want more minorities and more women, and we want a more inclusive environment. At the same time, we have to understand that people are feeling aggrieved because they feel there's less of a role for them in the society that they thought was all about them. And I think that one of the things that I've been talking to some colleagues about is how newsrooms have changed. I'm fairly ancient now, but when I was a boy in short pants in my 20s and I first stepped into a newsroom, these were rough places. They were all male. The women had very no roles or secondary roles, if any. There was a lot of hail fellow, well met, a little bullying, a lot of hazing, fair amount of alcohol. And we put up with this when we were starting out, because if someone said, well, maybe you should go into something a little more qualified or discreet, and my answer always was, what, and give up show business? It was the job that I wanted, and I was willing to endure a lot of stuff that my students will not put up with. And
that's a very valid point, Jeff. I'd never thought of that angle before, but it's a very, very valid point. On the other hand, it seems that some are, after this division has been created, they're more interested in highlighting the reaction of somebody. Oh my goodness, I can't believe they just said that to me. Oh, this is unacceptable behavior. Well, we all know that. But is anybody asking the question of why they're so angry, why they're frustrated, why they feel nobody is listening to them? It's all we're pointing out, don't be them. But we're not asking why they're upset.
Rodney King said it best when, after the Los Angeles riots, he said, can't we all just get along?
Yeah.
And I think that that's still a valid point. It's going to be tough. I'm a recovering historian, is my training. And I did a couple of degrees in French history. And the French went through this in the 30s, where there was this sense of the economy was changing, the government was changing, the old ways of doing things were changing. And there was a group of, I guess they were called in class terms, lower middle class, and they became enraged at the idea that they had no longer were running the show. And they called it in French, déracinement. Unrootedness. And so you had a lot of, in the 30s, the rise of some very nasty people that led into a very nasty situation in France during the war. And after the war, the same thing was going on in the 1950s, where people who were small business owners were feeling aggrieved and disenfranchised, partly because there was a wave of colonial immigration into France. And these people in French society felt that they were being replaced. And we're hearing a lot about the great replacement theory that's going on. Somehow, governments, by insisting on making room for people who were excluded, they also have to understand that they need to keep expanding the economic basis for our societies so that we all feel part of this. And that's the challenge right now. So what's happening at CTV is kind of a symbolic thing that is an expression of a lot of discontent, not just about ageism and sexism, although that's pretty prominent now, and how CTV is going to handle this. It's a good time not to be in management, I can tell you that. It's going to be a huge challenge for media organizations and governments and universities to restore the kind of condition of respect and role in the society that they once enjoyed. And maybe it won't happen. But at this point, now we are at that, I think, at that critical moment where we're kind of watching what everybody's doing, how people are responding, what are the kinds of solutions that we should be looking for. And it's we're in the middle of it right now.
Jeffrey Dvorkin with us, senior fellow Massey College, former director of journalism, University of Toronto Scarborough, author of Trusting the News in a Digital Age. As always, Jeff, thanks for the time. Be well.
You too, Scott. Thank you.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
Elon Musk says, oh, sorry, I haven't done this. 4:53, Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson. Will, on the board. Also, looking for your last word at 905-645-3221, star 9900 on your cell. Hammerhead trivia after the 5 o'clock news. Elon Musk says Tesla Motors is focusing on having self-driving vehicles on the road by the end of the year. Pipe dream or reality? Let's bring in David Booth, senior writer, Postmedia Driving, driving.ca, and he is with us now. David, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm very well, in fact.
So, David, we hear about this a lot. What does this mean by self-driving vehicles? Is it cruise control with the hands off? What, and are we set up from a municipal standpoint, from a governance standpoint? Are we ready for this?
Well, that's a different question on as to whether Elon Musk can make a full self-driving car by the end of the year. And I've got to say, he's starting to sound like some of the crazy conspiracy theory folks that he's now voting for, that he's now signaled his intention to vote Republican from now on. I mean, the lineup of obstacles between him and full self-driving by the end of the year are just so enormous. It's kind of funny to watch him ignore them. I mean, first off, he's been promising robot taxis pretty much every year for the last 3 years, and he was going to have a million of them next year. None of those have appeared. The NHTSA has a number of investigations of his products, some on automatic braking, and I think there's 83,000 vehicles under investigation for their current version of the self-driving software that he has. And just on Friday, there's been the launch of a, class action suit, that claims that Tesla's basically brake for hallucinations. You know, there's a U.S. senator that's campaigning, with his basic program being that Tesla full self-driving is unsafe. And at the same time, he says that full self-driving, which is the name of his software that isn't full self-driving, will actually be full self-driving by the end of the year. I mean, it's, you know, maybe he's been on Joe Rogan again smoking some ganja. I don't know.
What do you think the chances are that this company gets sold and somebody else picks it up?
I don't know. See, the problem, I don't know that it gets sold. I wonder about, I'd like to wonder about Musk's, you know, continued leadership of it. I mean, on the one hand, he keeps on acting crazier and crazier all the time. And, yet the problem is that he has so many followers, and his personality is so integral to the strength of that company. He's kind of like Trump and the Republican Party. You know, I mean, the man is batshit. You know what? And yet, everybody follows along because they think that as crazy as he may be, that's the only way they can get elected. So I don't know what the future of Tesla holds. I really don't. I you know, prognostications don't matter a bit in this. It's not a normal business case.
Elon Musk says Tesla Motors focusing on having self-driving vehicles on the road by the end of the year. But as David's reacting, maybe not so much. David Booth with us, senior writer, Post Media Driving, driving.ca. David, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
We've talked at length over the course of the show about Chrystia Freeland, Deputy Prime Minister, and the incident in Alberta where she was harassed by a person who was obviously unhappy with her politics. Across the nation now, Canadian politicians, current and former, are denouncing the incident, which happened in Alberta, against Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland. But is anybody asking why? Of course, it's obvious. Of course, yeah, it's bad. It's not good. That should never happen. Well, of course. Absolutely. Does that even have to be said? But are we addressing why? Are we talking about why the country is so divided, and what leaders are doing to fuel this divisiveness? The polarization we saw in the United States years ago, and we all said was coming here, and then watched it walk through the door. Are we surprised? Are we surprised this is going on when we have politicians denouncing us with polite arrogance? No matter what side of the political spectrum you're on. Let's bring in Tim Powers, Chairman, Summa Strategies, Managing Director, Abacus Data. He's with us now. Tim, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Scott, I am well. I'm in Newfoundland, and as you know, if I throw the rock far enough, I could get it into Alan Doyle's backyard. So, but I won't break his window because that would only be playing to the crowd right now and doing the same.
Oh, man. Oh, I wasn't sure where you were going with that, but what the heck? I'd go down and at least have a happy hour cocktail with the guy. What the heck?
Well, he's in PEI right now. He's doing a play in PEI. He's doing PEI. Come on, you're not up on your...
I'm not a band member activities.
Jeez.
I'm not getting the newsletter. I got to get on the fan club and make sure I get that reinstated there. All right. So, you know, it's easy to stand up and condemn this sort of thing, but are we fueling the fire here? Can we be surprised? Nobody likes to see this happening, but it seems we have divisive leaders nowadays that thrive on this.
Let me say one thing first. I saw a great tweet last night from somebody who used to work for and with Hamilton legend Sheila Copps. And no one should excuse what happened to Chrystia Freeland. I certainly don't, but Sheila Copps went through similar things. High-profile politicians went through it. The difference is today on social media, it's amplified, and we should be calling people out. But first point I'd make is, that amplification also encourages people to, you know, carry on with the behavior they did with Freeland. There was almost a joyful sort of exuberance that those who yelled out the insults and tried to intimidate Freeland had with their efforts. And to your point, which is arguably the bigger and the more important one, you have Justin Trudeau today, you have Pierre Poilievre today, yesterday, saying this is not acceptable. But in the case of both those leaders and many others, they too will play off of people's anger. They'll use language that divides. They'll all say the right things on days like today and over the weekend, but that hasn't stopped them from, you know, going down into the gutter and encouraging guttural behavior to advance their political agendas.
How much should the leadership of all parties be looking in the mirror on this issue? Is it all them or is it us? Is it us that we've just...
Well, it's all of us, right? Look, there's no... Sorry, I'm not to cut you off your question, but there's no... I think ultimately political discourse starts with leaders. So, and when you're campaigning, and you cited the Trump example, or you talked about polarization in the U.S., I mean, you know, when you speak of people in discarding tones, when you're beyond criticizing them or occasionally being funny and poking a little bit of fun at people, I'm okay with all of that. Humor is still important. Critique is vital. But when you make it so nasty and so personal and you glorify it, I mean, what is January 6th about if it isn't about glorifying, you know, brutality and encouraging loudish, dangerous behavior? And look in the U.S. how terrified people are in the Republican Party of going against Donald Trump, because there is some working effectiveness to all of that. So, we have to give people reason to find other places to direct their dissatisfaction, and we can't encourage violent language and potential violent behavior. It's going to lead us to a very, very bad place. Look at what's been happening in Britain. We've had MPs killed, we've had them stabbed, and it's all part and parcel of the climate in which we live, where we all, a lot of people think it's okay to move from language to physical force and violence to prove your point.
And of course, there's no way to excuse any of this activity. But when you're constantly pushing people's buttons on either side of the extreme, how can you be surprised when this happens? I mean, and I can think of the Prime Minister. I can think of and Polyev is no different with what he's doing on his side. But I mean, when you think of the Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, Melanie Joly, there's a very, very, very polite arrogance about them. And then when someone like this,
either.
No, it's not in the case of Minister Joly anyway. And then when all of a sudden, a bad example rears its ugly head, it's like, see, there's those people. There's those convoy people. As if the only one that's angry in the country is white guys. It's so distracting and it's so counterproductive by just saying, condemning these people with this poor behavior, as opposed to the man who created a ruckus in Ottawa when 90% of the truckers were already vaccinated. I mean, come on.
Yeah, it's a political formula, right? Because given how you win national elections, when you, Trudeau's case in the last one, you didn't even need more than 34%. So, you can find that 34-35% and play to them. It takes hard work to address the grievances of many and take the time to listen instead of playing off of them. And we've created such mechanized political leaders that, true leadership and of the Churchillian variety and the like in addressing bigger societal problems is thrown out the window. We look how we run political campaigns. They're so socially media focused by activating people on social media to respond in a certain way. I mean, look at, to Polyev's credit, how he's used his own direct form of communications to deliver messages to different groups that have some appetite for his freedom and other messages, and Trudeau does the same thing. So there's a lot to look at in all of this, but I still believe it ultimately starts with leadership and the people like you, me, and everybody calling things out when we see them, and then trying to have a civil discussion about these things, not always going into a corner and saying, you're an idiot because you think that, as opposed to, okay, I don't agree with you, but tell me why you think that.
And Aaron O'Toole tried to play the center, and look what happened to him. He had to walk the plank.
Yeah, but I don't think it's just about playing the center, Scott. I think there's we're missing civility, and civility doesn't, I think,
good point.
They hear the word civility, it means you're just some kind of pushover. You and I are of a similar age. When you grew up, yeah, people had pretty strong positions, but I remember being always told, listen to what the other side is saying, just don't disregard it. And we've thrown out any value of knowledge and wisdom and history. This stuff has happened before social media, people not listening to each other, and we've had lots of societal cleavage, death, and damage as consequences of that.
Well said. Tim Powers with us, Chairman Summa Strategies, Managing Director Abacus Data, talking about the toxic environment that is politics today. Tim, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Take care, my friend. Bye.
All right, let's bring in Christian Leprac, professor at both the Royal Military College of Canada and Queen's University, and fellow at the Macdonald Laurier Institute. It seems Ukraine military is changing the way it does things. And what about Russia and China teaming up for military exercises? Christian Leprac is with us now. Christian, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Yes, good afternoon, Scott.
We've had this discussion before, Christian. It just seems that, you know, after weeks and months and what have you, 6 month period, this is just dragging out. It's just, it's a long haul. It's a, just a tragic scenario, what we're seeing happen to Ukraine. And it's always sort of been defending itself. Is it changing its tactics now? Is it changing its strategy?
Well, we'll have to wait and see. Ukraine has announced counteroffensives before, repeatedly, sort of since the month of May. This could also be an effort just to throw off some of the Russian resource allocations and make them more uncertain. At the same time, Ukraine is, of course, under considerable pressure to make inroads, both because it's on a clock before the rainy season, because once the fields get all muddy, and we get sort of into the later fall, this will all grind to a stalemate by necessity. And of course, Ukraine is also under some pressure to show, to continue to have Western support so that Western weapons deliveries continue. And there's a risk here of fatigue among Western supporters for Ukraine. So this is, if this is the counteroffensive, it is a high-stakes political gamble that is not without considerable risk for both the Ukrainian military and the Ukrainian leadership.
So when will we know? I mean, there could be a lot of short-term gain or pain here.
So we may not know, or not know at least in the next couple of days, in the sense that the last thing Ukraine would want is a massive war of attrition with Russia, where it engages in the sort of mass onslaught that Russia has engaged in, because that's a conflict and a confrontation that Ukraine with fewer resources cannot win. Ukrainian strategy has been very adaptive at trying to use agility and high technology to its advantage. And so I would expect that if this is a counteroffensive, it would more reflect something akin to irregular warfare, where you have sort of individual strikes, you try to demoralize the Russians by hitting headquarters and supply lines, you might have a big attack here, a big attack there. So rather than one huge sort of front line and trying to make inroads across that front line, force the Russians to not quite know how to allocate their resources, where the next attack might come. So I think it'll be interesting to watch what strategy the Ukrainians believe they have with the relatively limited resources that are not giving outside observers necessarily full confidence that Ukraine can actually succeed, to show that this is actually doable and Ukraine has the means to push the Russians back.
How does Crimea play into all of this?
Yeah, good question. So Ukraine has been employing what it calls sort of a deep strike strategy. So to demonstrate that it can hit the Russians behind their own lines. And when it does hit the Russians on territory that the Russians claim as sort of Russian national territory as opposed to occupied territory. And Crimea, of course, is sort of an interesting sort of hybrid there. Ukraine has not claimed explicit responsibility for those attacks. In contrast, for instance, to the south of Ukraine or in the Donbas region when it has launched attacks. And so reaching deep into Crimea is important because that's where ultimately the troops that are supporting the south are stationed, where the supply lines are, where some of the headquarters capacity is. And we have to remember, in distinction to, for instance, the troops that came and tried to attack Kiev, the troops in the south, by and large, are pretty well-seasoned, coherent, cohesive fighting units that had been drawn together before the war, which is part of the reason why Russia was more successful in the south than it was in attacking Kiev. So the Ukrainians here are also up against a formidable fighting force.
Do you see the day when Ukraine retakes Crimea?
Certainly, that's what the leadership has promised. And I think this is the debate between, is this sort of World War One or World War Two scenario? In the World War One scenario, we basically grind to a halt and there's some sort of treaty. And then you have years of uncertainty, maybe a Kashmir type scenario. You continually have smaller or bigger flare ups for many years to come and an opportunity for the Russians to regroup. Whereas I think what President Zelensky has signaled is that Ukraine is gunning for a decisive victory here, in particular when it comes to the south, because the south is strategically what's really much more important to Ukraine than the Donbass region, because if Ukraine ends up being cut off from the ability to access the Black Sea and becomes landlocked, then Ukraine will be forever a rump state and completely impoverished. And so both the access to the sea as well as ostensibly control over Crimea would be key Ukrainian objectives. But clearly with the resources Ukraine currently has, reconquering Crimea is not in the near future as a prospect.
Russia preparing to begin military drills with China. How much of a concern is that?
Well, it's interesting, right? Because any of those drills would necessarily divert energy and resources from the fighting in Ukraine. And there's been complaints, for instance, within Russia that Russia continues to stage military parades and uses the military for all sorts of other nationalistic purposes that really don't serve the purpose of achieving military objectives in Ukraine. So in some ways, you can say, look, if the Russians want to have exercises with the Chinese and want to send troops there, from a Ukrainian perspective, all the better, because those are troops that are not going to be available, at least in the immediate term, to for the conflict in Ukraine. It'll be interesting to see to what extent that if they were going to cooperate, the Chinese and Russian military, it would mean that they would need to actually be able to ascertain sort of common objectives. So this might be more to see to what extent perhaps there's Chinese technology that the Chinese could sell to Russia that might be, that could be integrated with Russian capabilities. So I see it's less as a sort of strategic, say, alliance or so, or coalition, more than sort of an exploratory trying to figure out what they might be able to do together. And remember, Russia has considerable misgivings about China, especially in the east, where it has considerable also military concerns about potential Chinese territorial aspirations on Russia's east. So this is not necessarily going to be a very lasting friendship.
The West obviously supplying Ukraine. Any reason not to believe that China would do the same for Russia? I mean, if they are compatible.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting question, because what we've seen by Chinese entities is that, for instance, Chinese banks and some of the major Chinese industries have been quite reticent to cooperate with Russia, because the implication would be is that the Americans would impose sanctions that would then block them or risk them from being blocked from the international financial system, which could have very severe consequences for those institutions. So for all the people who are critics of the sanctions against Russia and that those aren't achieving anything, well, certainly in China, they've had a considerable deterrent effect on the engagement that especially Chinese individual Chinese entities have had with Russia. And that's a conundrum that China would have to overcome, because if it throws a slot in with China, it would have serious economic repercussions for China at a time when China is already facing massively slowing economic growth, when it is facing drought, and when it is facing a social unrest, and when it is facing a run on certain banks. So I'm not sure that the Chinese regime will necessarily want to pile on the economic and social challenges it's already confronting.
Christian Leprak, Professor, Royal Military College of Canada, Queen's University, and fellow at the Macdonald Laurier Institute. As always, Christian, thanks for the time. Be well.
My pleasure. Thank you, Scott. Have a lovely afternoon.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
Remember when the only thing you could get delivered to your house was like pizza or Chinese food? And what was it about those restaurants that made delivery perfect for them and not everybody else? Bizarre, because now you can virtually get anything from any restaurant anywhere because of food delivery services, which is great. Some people are really excited about that, some not so much, especially if you're standing in a line and somebody from a driving service goes up in front of you and goes into an express line and gets theirs first. But, you know, what about booze? The Beer Store says it now has more than 250 locations on Skip the Dishes after expanding its pandemic pilot project. I guess it's a great idea, but I'm surprised it's allowed. To me, it's not about the customer or the service. It's, will government allow this sort of thing? And clearly they do. Let's get Bruce Winder's take, retail analyst and author of Retail Before, During, and After COVID-19. He's with us now. Bruce, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Surprised that the Beer Store is jumping on board Skip the Dishes. And again, I thought the biggest challenge would be regulations, government and such.
Yeah, no, not super surprised. I mean, I know the Ford government relaxed some of the requirements during the pandemic, you know. So if you're a restaurant, you could ship alcohol along with your order. Mm-hmm. And that was to sort of try to help restaurants make a buck. And they extended it on. So not super surprised that this is happening. It's kind of a sign of the times. You can buy almost anything online, as you mentioned previously.
So what about fee? Is this any different than ordering a meal or anything else via Skip the Dishes or any of the other locations or any of the other services, rather?
I don't think so. I think it's very similar to everything else that you do on Skip the Dishes. I mean, there is fees associated with that, whether it's you pay within the price or whether the merchant pays, you know, there's someone's paying somewhere. But I guess, you know, these days consumers will pay for convenience. They've proven that, right? That, you know, if you're sitting at home with your pajamas and you want a six pack, then you're okay having that paid for by yourself or indirectly or something, paying more for the product, whatever the case is. So definitely there's a niche there where, and it's probably bigger than a niche, but a lot of folks are willing to pay for convenience now, much more than maybe 20 or 30 years ago.
It was interesting because last week we were talking, earlier on in the week we were, or no, it would have been last week, we were talking about tipping and how that's gone up from 10 to 15 to 20 and now up to 30%. But as you said, people will pay for the service. People will pay for the convenience. Is there a sweet spot when it comes to those fees? At what point do people say, you know, it's not worth it?
I think, you know, as long as they feel it's, you know, just a couple bucks, just a few bucks, they're willing to pay, right? You know, whether it's tip or whatever, you know, call it $5 or something. It really depends on the commodity. It depends on the provider and the customer, right? As long as they feel it's nominal. You know, I have a friend who worked at one of the food places, and they talked about someone who ordered, you know, a Coca-Cola bottle or Coca-Cola can, and it cost them $10 when all the fees were put in there. So there, you know, there's that's probably a real exception. But I think as long as it's seen as good value and it's not too much, you know, a few bucks here and there, I think you're not going to get much resistance from some people.
What about ID?
Yeah, well, I read in a posting here about this that the drivers have to be SmartServe approved, which means they have to show ID at the door. So it's actually fairly strict, you know. The Skip the Dishes has a fairly strict process in place where, you know, you have to, if they think you're inebriated, they won't ship you, they won't give you the alcohol, you have to show ID, you know, if they think you're buying it for a minor, they won't give you the alcohol. So there is some checks and balances in place here, thank God, that are still in place. And hopefully that works well to keep alcohol out of the hands of people who shouldn't have it.
What about the LCBO?
Yeah, the LCBO, I haven't heard much about that. I mean, I know I saw something somewhere about the LCBO allowing for online delivery and pickup. They opened up a website quite a while ago, and I'm assuming it's still going. And the LCBO has made some major inroads in the beer market over the last 20 years. You know, it used to be all the beer store, and that's sort of been broken up a little bit. And, you know, the LCBO's done quite well with beer, and even some of the big grocery stores have done pretty well with beer as well, right? So it's definitely not a cartel like it used to be. You know, there's a few spots where you can get beer. Obviously, it's different types of beer. The LCBO is more for the craft, I believe, an imported beer. But, you know, you can get beer in a few places now in Ontario.
Many thought the world was coming to an end when it went into, you know, the Costco's or the Walmart's or the grocery stores. What has been the result of all of this?
Well, I think, you know, overall, beer is a challenged category. You know, when I did some reading there a little while ago, beer is something that's actually in decline. You know, a lot of younger folks aren't really picking up a beer like maybe people our age used to. And they're opting more for alcohol or weed or things like that. So the beer market's sort of under fire anyways. And I think, you know, the more distribution points they have, the better chance they have of at least trying to maintain their top line.
Bruce Winder, retail analyst and author, Retail Before, During, and After COVID-19 is the book. As always, Bruce, thanks for the time. Be well.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
Beer store now announcing it's on Skip the Dishes. Skip the Dishes. Skip the Empties.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's a wrap for us. Thanks for listening. As always, greatly appreciated. And thanks to Will, the two Wills, for producing today. Diane and Dave in the newsroom. As always, we leave it to you, the tax-paying customer, to have the last word.
My name is Maria. So I am blind, and I was listening to the Elon Musk idea of having the self-drive cars. For years, I think myself and other blind people have said, get those things on the road. I mean, anybody who's lost their license or is 80-plus, who is blind, we want those cars. Heck, we can do even start a Twitter and Drive campaign for Elon. Hire us, hire us. We'll do it. Thank you.
There you go.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.